Black Law Student Association, Southwestern's Chapter of National Lawyers Guild, and Southwestern's Public Interest Law Society. We welcome you to this evening's event. We're going to go ahead and start off with a spoken word performance by HBO deaf poet and hip-hop theater artist and producer Mark Gonzalez.
How y'all doing?
Good.
All right. I think I heard five people. How's everyone doing? Yeah, we good.
What do you want?
What do I want? A lot of different things, you know, but it's not what I want, unfortunately. Well, maybe fortunately for some people. I think to some of us it might seem unconventional to start off an event about law, and especially the Patriot Act, with a performance, much less a poet. Some would call it unconventional, but I believe we live in unconventional times. In some way, the only way to bring the idiocracy, I guess you could say, of reality to the forefront is to break into unconventional. So that which is unconventional, we might be able to see a little bit more clearly. So at the end of this, I think you'll all see a little bit more about why we decided to start this event off this way. There's a homeless man standing on a crack corner singing salvation to the tune of Bob Marley's redemption song. We don't hear him, though. We'd rather pay him dimes than attention spans. My generation, we have this habit of wingspanning past history. Midnight shadowing elders into darkness. We don't want saviors. We require martyrs as in Gandhi, Malcolm, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. We choose their death over life like Barabbas over Christ. That's Marcus Garvey, Chief Joseph, Moses will tell you we chose 40 days and 40 nights for before 41 slugs. Who knew one damn thing about Amadou Diallo's life before destiny traded his soul for eminence? Wonder if his kids would trade infinite pictures of daddy's face on these nationalistic kites to snatch him from death womb or bolt him back into life to Sundance in the smell of their father's arms once again. Mothers will tell you it's easier to put fist in air than put food on child's plate consistently. I don't need prophecies to tell me there's a delicate balance in living, and sometimes angels, well, they do dive off clouds to tip the scales in our favor, but we don't want saviors, so they fall. Break wings on concrete on cold winter nights. They tremble, tuck them under the jackets to help keep the cold out. Now stand on this crack corner disguised as this homeless man singing salvation to the tune of Bob Marley's redemption. Still offering us up prayers quicker than piano keys to the fingers of Duke Ellington while the soul of John Lee Hooker's bluesing like George Gershwin, wailing like one of these mornings we're gonna rise up singing. But you know it's hard to sing when your communities have gone from financially viable to economically impotent. All thanks to this president who thinks he's Prince labels my people, formerly known as indigenous, now called a legal immigrant in our own land, beaten like Palestinians, stolen like innocents. What kind of world is this? Children get molested by an uncle named Sam. You want to complain about the Taliban? My block looks like Afghanistan. Act two. You know I like to dance sometimes. But sometimes it seems when I go to work, I gotta dance. And when I go to school, I gotta dance. And when I'm in a relationship, I gotta dance. Welcome to a world of convoluted concertos, where puppet CEOs create modern media minstrel shows, and if you don't get in line, you get left behind. So dance, motherfucker, dance, and everybody wanna be a star. Only we try so hard star searching that we burn out like played out metaphors. And to most people, they didn't know anything about poetry until Broadway. In the future, Def Jam could become Def Slam as our government already turned making the band into remaking the empire. And soon we'll invade Iran like we did Iraq and Vietnam. And I see the framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal within the case of the Imam Jamil. And all we can do is shake our ass like that little baby on Ally McBeal. So dance, motherfucker, dance. And why is Spike Lee making commercials for the U.S. military? As Disney replaces Samba with Simba in Pocahontas? And in the new millennium, genocide is the ultimate TV reality show being sponsored by Starbucks, who helped fund Palestinian Holocaust in the West Bank, where Israelis dress in Palestinian face and pretend that they're the victims, while in this country, politicians spend less on schools, more on prisons. In the world, white men still run 98% of corporations and scream to me about reverse racism. Fine. Y'all want to trade races? Let's go back in time. I'll build boats to sack Anglo-Saxons in ships like sardines, send you back across the Atlantic and call it the Middle Finger Passage. How about I set sail for Spain to discover Europe and call your ass savage? Let's invade Britain because they're Christian. Create apartheid in Nebraska. Force you to work the coal mines in South Dakota like the diamond mines in Africa. I mean, you're always quoting some Bible verse. Doesn't it say the first becomes last, last becomes first? So let's reverse the earth. Let's make heterosexuals live in a closet. If not, they get Matthew shepherded like sheep out to empty plains for slaughter. World where white men gotta wiggle their ass to make a living. Spend days, nightmares, dreaming, screaming, wondering which direction the next fist is gonna come from. His family's in Colorado, I'm dodging bombs, so Columbine is the least of your worries. A world where you're writing these words and I'm asking you, excuse me, why are you so angry? And this poem is not about hate. It's about rage. Finding an original way, say, until you've walked millennia miles between crack vials and migrant fields, prisons and mortuaries. You will never know the pain that comes from genocide being the ultimate TV reality show and seeing your people minstrel across the globe. And if you don't act now, in the next 6 minutes, change all this shit. Don't you know, bro? You got the next star and roll. So dance, motherfucker, dance, act three. You don't have to resurrect Machiavelli to realize the similarities between death row record sales and death row prison cells. For I believe, the way this is world is going, that the next world war will be fought against the US, Britain, and Israel, with George Bush screaming like Tupac, it's just me against the world. Haven't you heard? Dick Cheney is Suge Knight. Or better yet, maybe he's Walt Disney. This is a movie, you're Pinocchio and John Ashcroft's Geppetto. Standing behind the scenes, pulling all the strings, making your feet dance faster than Savion on Broadway. And am I the only person who knew that September 11th was just a minstrel play? Osama was really a white man dressed in Arab base from the CIA, and the planes were just props for the war with Iraq. Over time, you'll find that the media are mimes acting out pre-memorized lines on primetime. As ABC and NBC feed the war frenzy, and we move from Act 1, the war against terrorism, to Act 2. World War III. Shh. Quiet on the set. The backdrop is the State of the Union address. Life, exit stage right, death, enter stage left, and we all play a part in this next scene, where Congress convenes for the last time right before Thurgood Marshall law is imposed and the Department of Homeland Defense becomes the department formerly known as COINTELPRO. Then this moron known as Condoleezza will sell out her people. Colin Powell just resigned. The world will realize that the U.S. is a pimp. The U.N. Security Council is its trick in buying drug and paying taxes while they both support terrorists. And I love Act 3, where the people of the Philippines seize the U.S. Army bases forced upon them during imperialism. Venezuelan citizens will demand reparations for the genocide caused by neoliberalism and free trade. The FBI, the CIA, NYLA, UC, and every other pig D will finally be tried for their crimes against humanity. And the list goes on and on and on and on, and damn, this play's getting long. I'm getting a little thirsty. The world is more than a little hungry for justice. Its stomach rumbles, the earth shakes. Was it a nuclear bomb or just a fake? Maybe what you thought was an earthquake was the sound of 1 billion Africans storming Britain, trying parliament for the rape of an entire continent. Maybe what you thought was thunder was the sound of Native Americans and Bosnians, Pakistanis, Palestinians, and Indians realizing how much we have in common. Maybe lightning flashes with the frequency of 25 million blacks taking back their lives, 20 million indigenous taking back our land, 10 million Asians are brooding the railroads, burning down the ghettos, the prisons, the Walmarts, the Nordstroms, the Macy's, these toothpick cities they force us to live in, trying to reclaim our souls. Our schools, we'll build them. Their schools, we'll destroy them. Their books, I'll rewrite it. If they try to fight them, look in the eye and say, hey, why complain? Nothing's gonna change. That's just the way life is. And see how they like it when our flag is flying, their body's dying. Fuck George Bush. Fuck the police. No justice, no peace. Because freedom is like a train called change, and they're standing on the tracks at high noon. Can you hear the whistle blowing? Liberation approaching like a steam engine rolling. Tell Aviv it's time for Israel's erosion. Call Ariel Sharon on the phone at home, because I'm like LL on a cell. I rock the Alexander Graham Bells. I used to tell Tom secrets till I found out Tom would only tell. So now the only thing I tell Tom is rewind, cause this rhyme mind of mine is like a gift from the divine, therefore it's immaculate. I don't have to coat my throat with Coca-Cola to make these words plastic. Attack this mic like I was a savage and it was a colonialist. Twist this mind of mine like lyrical licorice. Me without the divine is like diabetics with pixie sticks. It's pure suicide. It's like reading Bible or Quran while rubbing the inside of a girl's thighs. What you need to be massaging is your mind, figuring out how to rewind time, recreate 48 and free Palestine. Oh, go back to 1776, overthrow the U.S. and the British, create the United States of the African indigenous. I told you, we're lyrical licorice and we're coming in three flavors, red, black, and freedom. And the reason why we started this event off this way is based upon my understanding of, I believe it's Section 802 of the Patriot Act. Some argue that this kind of performance or this kind of speech can be labeled as actual terrorist acts. Regardless of whether that's true or not, actual investigations have been done upon artists for their statements under that section, and those investigations do nothing more than amount to intimidation and coercion of an amount of stifling of some forms of political speech. And so I think it's easy for us when we bring things out, even just in a performance space, to be able to look at it and deconstruct it and be like, wow, how far have we really come to this point where our language is so limited that we have to police not only our bodies, but our minds, our thoughts, and our tongues.
Of this year marked the third anniversary of the Patriot Act. Just so we're all clear, the Patriot Act is an acronym, and it stands for Uniting and Strengthening America by Providing Appropriate Tools Required to Intercept and Obstruct Terrorism. The bill was received on the night of October 24th, in 2001, and passed unanimously October 25th. Many of the congresspeople who did actually vote for it, because it passed unanimously, have since said that they voted for this 342-page piece of legislation out of the fear of being perceived as unpatriotic following September 11th. Some of the tools that the Patriot Act has given to law enforcement to deal with terrorism are the power to track internet communications, wiretap phones, and computer communications, obtain search warrants for emails and voicemail communications. I think it's very important for us as law students and for active citizens to study and understand the effects of the Patriot Act. The legislation does represent a delicate balance. On the one hand, we need to protect our country and its citizens against foreign and domestic threats. And on the other hand, we have the importance of preserving our constitutional rights. Tonight, we hope that this discussion will ensue and it will be enlightening to all of us, and it'll be educational, and that we'll have very healthy debates about what the reality of the Patriot Act really is. So, at this point, I'd like to introduce our panel and our moderator. First of all, we have Sherman Austin, who is a local LA activist, and he is the founder and former webmaster, very important to say, former webmaster of RaiseTheFist.org. Sherman was actually incarcerated, and they used the Patriot Act, and as Mark alluded to, the sense of fear that invoking the Patriot Act can impose on people to actually enter his house. They used that as a means to enter his house and search his belongings and his computer and all of those things. So he's going to talk to us about his actual personal experience and tell his story. Our next panelist is Steve Rohde. Mr. Rohde is a practicing attorney and partner in the law offices of Rohde and Victoroff. He is the former president of the Los Angeles chapter of the ACLU and has worked on many civil rights cases that have arisen out of the Patriot Act. Our third panelist is Professor Catherine Dahmer. She is currently a professor at Chapman University School of Law. She teaches criminal procedure and advanced criminal procedure currently, which includes a focus on anti-terrorism. She also teaches evidence. Her recent publications include Civil Liberties versus National Security in a Post 9/11 World, and she's actually, we've got copies of the book for sale right here. She also served as a U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York from 1995 to 1999. And we also have our very own Professor Gunning as our moderator tonight. Professor Gunning is faculty here at Southwestern. She's also a graduate of Yale Law School. She serves as a pro bono mediator with various organizations throughout Los Angeles. She's also involved with many dispute resolution centers. She's a member of the American Bar Association's Skills Training Committee, member of the Board of Clinical Legal Educators, as well as being editor of the Clinical Law Review. So we thank you all for being here tonight.
Our format, as people may know, is that we're going to have each of our panelists make their presentation. Can't hear me. I'm sorry. I've kind of got a cold. I'll try to project. Our format is going to be that we'll have each of our panelists speak for about 20 minutes, and then we're going to open it up for questions. And my job is basically going to just be to point to folks and just make sure that we all these are important issues, and I hope that people have some really strong feelings about things, but nonetheless that we all treat each other with the respect that we all deserve. And so with that very mini introduction, I'll ask Sherman to start.
Hi, my name's Sherman Austin. In the year of 2000, at around I think the month of February it was, I started a website called RaiseTheFist.com. And at that time, it was, you know, basically in its early stages, in the process of growing, and it was pretty much an anarchist, independent media website, with different news that's of different events going on around the world and just different issues from everything from police brutality to various environmental issues to corporate globalization, stuff like that. And you know, as time went on, as the year went on, and more towards late of 2000. The website started to get a lot more popular, a lot more people started coming to the website, and it actually more of developed into an open publishing website where people can go online, just go right onto the website and automatically publish their own articles to a newswire, which was basically viewable to anyone who came on the website. And, the site was up, and it was getting a lot of hits daily, and the more hits it was getting from, people around the world, the more government hits it was getting, and it started getting, hits and started getting monitored from government agencies, not just within the U.S., but other countries as well, such as, everywhere from Australia, Canada. I even got, a lot of government hits from, Japan, Egypt, Department of Defense agencies. Here in the United States, the FBI, local police, and who else knows, I don't know beyond that, but I'm sure a lot more besides them also came to the website. But January of 2001 came around, January 24th, which was only 3 months after the Patriot Act was passed. My house was surrounded by about 20, 25 armed federal agents from the FBI Secret Service and a few LA police officers from the Joint Terror Task Force. And they were basically, pretty heavily armed with submachine guns, shotguns, bulletproof vests. And they had the whole house surrounded with loaded weapons before they pretty much came to the door and tried to come in the first time. Luckily, my sister was home, and she told me that there was a bunch of FBI-looking cars and police cars parked all up and down the street. So I got up and went to the door, and the agents came back to the door and pulled me outside asking if I was Sherman Austin. And at that time, I saw agents emerge from all angles of the house coming out with their guns drawn, and they basically handed me a 25-page warrant, I think it was, and then just came into the house, knew exactly where my room was, and where my room was, where I was hosting the website. I was actually running a computer network, which was hosting RaiseTheFist.com, and they went straight to the room and dismantled the network and started basically mirroring each drive, downloading all the data off my hard drives onto government hard drives before they boxed everything up and loaded it into a big white truck, which was sitting outside. And during this whole process, I was interrogated by the two special agents who were conducting the raid on the house, and this lasted about 4 or 5 hours. And during this time, I was asked questions like if I'd like to see the president killed, and things like that. And it was just completely ridiculous. And I asked the agents, how could you come to my house and take these computers over a website? And they said, well, actually, it's legal now under the U.S. Patriot Act. because of the content on your website. And I said, what content? And they said, the explosive information on your website. And it's important to point out that there was never any kind of explosive information on my website, that being information about bombs and whatnot. What there was on my website was a link to an entirely different website, which I didn't author, implement, or create in any way, shape, or form. This other website had about 7 pages, and on one of those pages was not very detailed information at all that described information about different various explosives. And this website was created by another individual, and I only had a link on my website to this other person's website, and on one of the pages on that website existed this information. So it's just important to point that out. But you know, that's not what the agent said. They said I created it, and they even asked me, like, did you create this website? They asked me about 10 different times, and I told them no very directly. I didn't author that website or implement it or create it in any way, shape, or form. I didn't even put it online. I just simply had a link to the website. So, you know, the interrogation process lasted the, you know, entire raid, and they basically left. My room was ransacked. They had confiscated not just computers, but political literature, protest signs, and they just had it all boxed up in a white truck and left. And right before they left, the head agent conducting the raid, Special Agent John I. Pye, said that I had crossed over a line, and as long as I got back over on the other side of that line, everything would be okay. And what he meant by that, which is what I found out later down the line. And, you know, after what happened, I still continued my plans to attend the World Economic Forum protest in New York, which was scheduled to happen, I think it was about a week and a half later. So I went to New York, and once I got there, I was waiting in Columbus Circle for the march to begin. And at that time, about 30 cops just basically ambushed a piece of the crowd and scooped up and arrested 26 demonstrators, one of which was me. And they basically put us in a bus and, you know, took us to Brooklyn Navy Yard Jail, where we were for about 30 hours, and everyone started getting released. And then they took me out of the cell, put me in handcuffs, and put me into a back room, and I was interrogated again by a detective from the FBI and a Secret Service agent. And I was asked questions about the raid that happened in California, and I was asked questions about RaiseTheFist.com, my website, and I was asked questions like if I was a terrorist or involved in any terrorist organizations, if I knew of any plans of violence that were going to happen at the protests, what trains I took to get into Manhattan, why I came to the demonstration, and just complete ridiculous questions. I mean, from my opinion on it, I think they obviously knew I wasn't a terrorist. It was just this whole, you know, agenda they were on, trying to get something to make it look like they were justified in pretty much doing what they did. But, you know, after that, that whole interrogation process lasted about 3-4 hours until they said I wasn't going to be able to leave New York until they searched my car. And I said, you know, I had nothing to hide. I have nothing to hide. And I just basically signed over the keys and said, go ahead and search it. I just want to leave. You know, I just came here to protest and, you know, exercise my First Amendment right. And I was sitting there being interrogated in handcuffs by 2 federal agents. And, you know, I basically told them that, and they took the keys. And then 5 minutes later, I was actually released and taken to the courthouse, where I waited for about 30 minutes for a ride to come and pick me up, when about 4 FBI agents came into the building and said I was under arrest for posting information to the Internet about explosives. And they basically hurried me out of the courtroom, grabbed me by my neck, and put me in this black SUV and drove me to a federal building where I was being processed, and they tried to question me again before putting me in a 24-hour lockdown maximum security cell in Manhattan MCC. And I was basically there, and I had a bail hearing in which the judge denied me bail, saying I was a threat to the community. The FBI said I came to New York because I was a man on a mission, and I had a plot I was going to carry out, and I couldn't be released to return back to California on my own to face the charges, because on the way back, I was going to stop off at Utah and burn the Olympics. So, yeah, and unfortunately, the judge believed all of it, and they read quotes that were supposedly posted to my website that weren't even said by me, saying that I was a terrorist and all this other nonsense. So the judge fell for it, I guess, and I was rendered a threat to the community, and I was going to be extradited back to California in custody of the U.S. Marshals. And on my way back to California, I was awaiting my next transfer in Oklahoma, which is basically a federal transfer center. It's where they bring inmates It's like a central hub where they bring inmates before they take them other places throughout the country, whether they're going to their designated institution or to wherever their charges originated from. So I was waiting there for about 2 days until I received information that the prosecutors decided not to do an indictment. So I was just basically released. And during this whole time, the 2 weeks I was in this 24-hour lockdown, maximum security jail cell, being called a terrorist and a threat to the community, several mainstream newspapers like the New York Post and, L.A. Times and stuff said I was, a teen terrorist. And they had, headlines reading baby bomb bust and that the FBI had caught one at the demonstration. And I was played out to be this, pretty dangerous person. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, I was just released. And I went home by myself on an airplane back to California. And it's just like, it didn't make any sense. One second I was just big, dangerous terrorist that the FBI, just had arrested and was, being held in a maximum security jail cell. And the next moment I was just let out the door and I put on an airplane by myself and back to California. And that was it. I was just on my own pretty much then. And once I got back to California, I got RaiseTheFist.com back online. And at that point, because of what happened, it actually gained, a lot more publicity and a lot more support from people, and a lot of more people started knowing about the website and coming to the website. And during this time, there was a 6 months of period where, I continued my, organizing within the community, setting up various programs, Through Not Bombs programs, free clothing programs. We tried to get a cop watch program started out in Long Beach to monitor police activity because, police brutality and, police murder is pretty rampant out there in Long Beach. I don't know if any of you have been to Long Beach, but it's probably one of the worst places as far as police brutality in Southern California. But, I did just basically continued organizing within the community, continued speaking specifically about my case and what had happened with the FBI and Raise the Fist. And during that time period, Raise the Fist started to develop more into a direct action network and not just a website. People started setting up their own chapters within their own schools, just on their own. Naming the chapters Raise the Fist. People started setting up their own chapters, within their own communities called Raise the Fist. And so, the site started to develop more into something that just wasn't, talking about things and sharing your opinions. It was, putting your words into action. The website became a tool and a resource for people to organize and communicate with one another, to network and coordinate with one another, not just here in the United States, but globally. And it became this global direct action network, which was, growing pretty rapidly. There was, chapters in Brazil and Germany and, various places within the United States. And, during this time, I, faced, harassment, not just, from federal authorities, not just wiretaps and, internet taps, but also harassment from local authorities, from, local Long Beach Police Department, who had my picture hanging up in their police station. And I'd be stopped on the street. One time, for example, I was stopped just riding my bike down the street. And I was stopped by three patrol cars, and they all came out of their cars. They all knew my name, and started asking me questions about Raise the Fist. Asking me antagonistic questions like, why do you hate cops so much, and stuff like that. Just getting into pointless little debates with me and stuff like that, and just showing that they know, and like just showing that they can intimidate or whatever. But things like that would happen. I couldn't even go to other friends' court hearings who had other cases without getting within, just a few blocks of a courthouse and literally being swarmed by police in patrol cars following me till I parked and getting out of their cars, questioning me why I was there, what was going on that day. And then after that, leaving the car with a patrol car down the street, just sitting there the whole time until I came back and left, knowing basically, I guess, so they knew I was gone. And, things like this would happen all the time. I couldn't go to demonstrations without police just following me every step I took with a camera in my face. When I first got out, I went to a demonstration to support the Taco Bell boycott in Irvine. And because I was there, there was a special agent there with the FBI who had an undercover in the crowd who was taking pictures of people. And it was pretty funny because he came right up to me directly in front of me and just started snapping photos of me and went back to the special agent who had a nice suit on and showed him the pictures and loaded another roll of film and started literally 2 feet in front of me, started taking, more pictures. And, this went on, and then I received one of the National Lawyer Guild lawyers came up to me and told me that, I better leave the demonstration. the FBI had told the police chief there, who told him that the FBI was basically knew I was there, knew about my case, knew I had just gotten out, and were looking for basically anything to arrest me on. So, you know, I was pretty much forced to leave with, you know, those conditions. So, you know, this kind of harassment and this intimidation went on for a period of 6 months while I continued organizing. And then after that, you know, 6 months, I received a call from my lawyer who said he had heard back from the prosecutor, and the prosecutor told him that they decided not to, they had looked through all the computers they had seized from the house, but really had found, they didn't find anything really to prosecute me on, but they still didn't want to let me off the hook. And they wanted to get me to sign a plea indictment, plea agreement to a distribution of information related to explosives or weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, I didn't want to sign it because I didn't author any information like that. I didn't, you know, put any information like that on the internet. But, you know, I went, tried to deal with it. And the first time we were dealing with it, I was told that I'd only be looking at maybe 3 or 4 years if I would be convicted in trial. And, you know, I said, you know, what the hell? I didn't do it. Let's go to trial. And, you know, things went back and forth. And as I kept resisting the plea, this thing came up about a terrorist enhancement, which would add an additional 20 years, up to an additional 20 years onto my sentence if I had been convicted in trial. And, you know, at that time, I didn't really have the resources to fight a case. I had a public defender. And, you know, I was looking at, you know, 23, 24 years in prison for something I didn't even do. And, you know, the way things were going with the political climate at the time, I was pretty much, you know, pressured, and I felt, you know, pretty threatened that I had to sign this plea or I was going to, you know, potentially go to prison for 24 years. And so, you know, I know the choice but to sign a plea. And at the time I signed the plea, it was only 4 months in jail and 4 months in a community correction center. And we brought it before Judge Stephen V. Wilson, and he denied it, saying that, you know, what kind of deterrence would it set for future revolutionaries who wanted to act out in the same manner? You know, pretty much stating that he wanted to set an example. And, you know, he rejected it and ordered the prosecutor to consult with the head of the FBI, who was Robert Mueller at the time, and Justice Department, to get their opinion on the sentencing before coming back to a next court hearing. And so that happened in a... From what the prosecutor said, the FBI and the Justice Department agreed with the sentencing, but Judge Wilson obviously had his own plans when he decided just to sentence me to a straight year in prison. And it's also important to point out that 2 weeks prior to them actually contacting my lawyer and saying that they wanted me to sign this plea for this information that was on the internet, 2 weeks prior to this, the FBI had actually gone to the kid's house, who had actually put the information online, who had actually authored the website, which was known as the Reclaim Guide, titled the Reclaim Guide, which contained this information on it, which reclaimed the this explosive information on it. They knew the person who actually put this information on the internet. They went to his house. They interviewed him. He voluntarily told them, you know, I put this information online. There wasn't any question about it. There wasn't any question about who put that information there. They knew who put that information on the internet. And they deliberately lied about it by saying that, you know, once I told them, while they were at my house, I told them that I didn't author the information at all. They deliberately lied about it, saying that in the pre-sentencing report and other court documents that I admitted to authoring, implementing, and creating the website, the Reclaim Guide, which had the information on it, which contained the explosive information. And it's also in the discovery where you can see that they went to this kid's house, interviewed him, and knowing that he created the website on the explosive information. And another page in the discovery shows that I said that I admitted to authoring the information. And there are two pieces of evidence that are very contradicting and obviously show that it was a direct lie by the FBI in order to basically coerce me into signing the plea by basically stating that, you know, basically lying that I had written this information, which I'd obviously not. But I think, you know, it's important to point out that this shows that they weren't concerned about explosive information being available on the internet. I mean, there's thousands of websites you can go to online that are readily available to the public that contain, you know, much more detailed information on how to manufacture, implement, and use bombs, explosives. I mean, you can go to howthingswork.com and probably type in explosives, and it shows you diagrams of whatnot on how to build explosives and bombs. If they were so concerned about this type of, you know, material being available to the public on the internet, they would have tons of other websites to deal with. They wouldn't be wasting their time with RaiseTheFist.com. The reason why they did, you know, obviously put a time and effort and investigation and, you know, this whole raid and all that into RaiseTheFist.com was merely the fact that it was a voice, it was a tool, it was a resource, it was being used to get people out there to organize. It was, you know, an independent media website, it was an anarchist website. It's obviously, you know, I think this case obviously shows one thing, that this with the Patriot Act, it obviously shows that, you know, this new intensified level of political repression is used to set, you know, excuses and justifications were obviously not true, but when they can use this keyword terrorist, they can automatically convince people, especially, you know, people in power like judges and prosecutors, that, you know, something's up here, something needs to happen, and that, you know, this person is a threat to national security, which is also what they said. It was, you know, this is, you know, a case of national security. And so I think it's just important to point out that, you know, they deliberately lied about saying the explosive information was on the website. And if they were actually concerned about the website, I don't think they would have came after me and prosecuted me. They would have came after the kid who actually wrote this information and put it up with the intent that the information be used, as he stated on his website, at an event to protest the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., which was canceled because of September 11th. The Reclaim Guy, the website he created, was originally written for that specific protest, and he had different links on the website, I guess. And he states right there on his website that this information is for this event. And if you put, you know, intent and distribution together, I mean, there's no one else to go after but him. I mean, not saying that I think the law should be enforced. I think the statute is completely ridiculous. I mean, I received a letter, not a letter, I received a copy of a press release Dianne Feinstein released the day I was ordered to self-surrender, saying that she was concerned over a statement I had made in a prior interview to turning myself in, that this type of information is available on thousands of other websites. And I don't know what made her so concerned if she were to sponsor and write a law that would directly, you know, pretty much infringe on this type of material being out there. I mean, I would think that if she were to sponsor and create such a statute, that she would know beforehand that this type of information was everywhere in thousands of different websites and libraries and, you know, was readily available at your fingertips. And, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, these types of laws are passed with, you know, very little thinking. They're just swept through, you know, Congress and whatnot. But, you know, this law was passed, the statute that she had written was passed in 1997, actually. It wasn't passed under the Patriot Act. The raid happened under the Patriot Act, but this statute was actually passed in 1997. And the first time it was used and enforced was in my case, which resulted in me spending a year in prison, in federal prison, a medium security prison in Tucson. And, you know, basically, after my court hearing, I was ordered to self-surrender 30 days later, which I did. And I just basically spent a year in prison in the desert. I like to say for a crime I didn't commit, but if you look at the real reason why they did what they did, I wouldn't say it was a crime. I would say it was something I did, which was run RaiseTheFist.com and create a voice and speak up and, you know, challenge, you know, the things this administration is doing, not just this administration, but the system as a whole is doing in this country and what this country is doing, you know, as far as, you know, everything from, you know, domestic foreign policy to privatization to, you know, police brutality and its, you know, entire U.S. military police state apparatus being enforced in other countries to enforce its imperialist interest. I think it's important to point out that that was the reason why I was in prison, not because of the statute. The statute was simply used as a mere justification under the with help of the Patriot Act, but with help under this new political agenda they're on, under this new intensified political repression that they're on, to create a justification and excuse with this whole national security and terrorist hysteria, to create a justification why I need to be put in prison. So, you know, that's basically that. And I was released in July 14th, and I'm here now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Sherman. I'm sure people are going to have some questions for you later, but we're going to move on and talk a little bit more about this law that you got caught up with. And we'll start with, did you guys flip a coin on who's going to start on this? Steve, Catherine?
You'll go first this week.
Okay. Pleasure to be with you. I'm delighted you've come out on this important topic and that you're with us. I'm proud to be sitting next to a free Sherman Austin. Sherman's story has to be worrisome and a cautionary tale for anybody who's concerned about our liberties and our freedoms. And what we're going to do tonight is talk a little bit about that in the context of the Patriot Act. I'm eager to hear what you have to think and say and the questions that you're going to present. Let me use a little bit of my time to try to put this in a historical context, because this chapter in American history doesn't stand out by itself. It seems to me that in American history, we've had many shameful chapters in which America has lost its way, in which, because of fears of threats, foreign or domestic, we have abandoned civil liberties, we have violated the Constitution, and then it takes years and generations later to look back and wring our hands and realize what's been done. The ink was barely dry on the Bill of Rights in 1798 when the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed during the John Adams administration. And right off the bat, you see this ugly coupling of the Alien and Sedition Acts, the Alien Acts against foreigners, against immigrants. At that time, it was the French. Nothing's changed, I guess. And then the Sedition Act, punishing journalists for criticizing the government during the Adams administration. Hundreds of journalists were punished. And a serious violation of the First Amendment occurred right in the shadow, right in the days and years after the First Amendment was written and ratified. And then during the Civil War, that great American president, Abraham Lincoln, suspended the writ of habeas corpus. In this room and in this building, I don't have to pause and talk that much about the writ of habeas corpus, the great writ borrowed from English law, so important a writ that it provided you could be brought before a court to challenge your detention or your incarceration, so important that it was written into the text of the U.S. Constitution, even before the Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution. Yet, fearing for what we today call national security, Abraham Lincoln, in violation of the express terms of the Constitution, as president, as the executive, suspended the writ of habeas corpus. And during World War I, we had the Espionage and Sedition Acts. We had the Palmer Raids, when another attorney general, Mitchell Palmer, rounded up dissidents and dissenters and anarchists and others, a sweeping arrest and detention, and then deportations following quickly after that. And under the Sedition Act, Eugene Debs, a great American who had run for president on the socialist ticket, was arrested and charged and convicted of violating the Espionage and Sedition Act for giving a speech in Canton, Ohio, which is far less than the talk I'm giving right now. And his conviction was upheld by none other than Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., in a series of cases that first tested the free speech protections in the Supreme Court. And coming down more recently and within the lives of a few of us in this room, over 110,000 Japanese Americans in World War II were torn from their homes and offices, interned in camps up and down this coast, their only crime being their heritage. Two-thirds of them were American citizens. I only point that out to emphasize the outrage because the U.S. Constitution protects persons. It is not limited in its protections to merely citizens. And those Japanese Americans were sent away and their property was taken, and the U.S. Supreme Court in the Korematsu case upheld the internment of the Japanese. And it would take years later in the Reagan administration and a special commission that was appointed for everyone to realize the gross injustice that had occurred. The commission studying this found that the military had lied to the U.S. Supreme Court, had exaggerated the foreign threat, and in all of that had violated the rights of all of those individuals. And today, upwards of $1.6 billion in reparations have been paid to Japanese Americans in some small way to make up for that gross violation. And there have been other violations down through the years during the McCarthy era and more recently. My question for you tonight throughout this discussion is whether this will be another shameful chapter in American history when rights are violated in the name of protecting the very freedoms on the one hand that the government is violating on the other hand. Or can this be another, or maybe the first, courageous chapter in American history, when in our lifetimes, when in our time, we resist the abuses under the Patriot Act, and we stand up to what's going on in other abuses as well, because it's hardly limited to the Patriot Act. And I only come out for these talks, this is about literally the 120th speaking engagement I have given since 9/11 to synagogues and mosques and churches and colleges and community groups. I only come out to have these talks in order to inspire you to do several things, to study the history of this period, to educate yourselves, and then to organize and to put your efforts in reconciling the balance between civil liberties and national security. Two resources I want to recommend to you for that effort. One is Professor Dahmer's book. She has edited an extraordinary collection of essays examining both sides of this issue. It's worthy reading. And an extraordinary new book that has just come out called Perilous Times: Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terrorism, by Jeffrey Stone. Perilous Times. Whatever else you're reading in the law school, read this. Perilous Times. And the other book is Civil Liberties versus National Security in a Post-9/11 World. I just want to take a few minutes because law schools, I think this one among others, are teaching an entire semester on the Patriot Act and the balance between these liberties. So we cannot hardly, in a few minutes tonight, devote ourselves to a full examination. I want to be sure you understand that the Patriot Act was written and introduced in Congress within weeks after 9/11. Now, I've been saying in these many talks that I believed that the Patriot Act was written before 9/11, that much of it was stored in John Ashcroft's far-right hand drawer. Well, recently, I've had the opportunity on four occasions to debate the Department of Justice through Luis Flores, a lawyer for the Department of Justice. And at our first engagement, he spoke first, and he got up and he told the audience that much of the Patriot Act was written before 9/11. We just couldn't get it passed, he said. He thought that advanced his position somehow. I found it an extraordinary confirmation of what I'd been saying for 3 years. This is a law that sweepingly changes not only the laws regarding terrorism, but the laws regarding the criminal justice system broadly. There's portions and perhaps percentage-wise much of the Patriot Act that civil libertarians don't take exception with, and I'm not going to be painted into the corner of suggesting that the entire Patriot Act should be repealed, but I am deeply concerned about specific provisions, which I hope we'll talk about tonight. The other good thing about having discussed this for so many years is that finally the courts are catching up with the civil libertarians. And two portions of the Patriot Act have already been struck down by district courts. And in an extraordinary set of opinions, which I hope you will at least study if we don't get the time to explore them, in the Jose Padilla and the Yasser Hamdi and in the Razul Guantanamo Bay detainee cases, finally the U.S. Supreme Court spoke out and resisted the administration's notion that it was above the law. Those cases didn't deal directly with the Patriot Act, but they certainly confronted an administration which has been saying for 3 years that the president in time of war is entitled to great deference and must not be bottled in by the courts. And because it was framed as a challenge to the courts, for once the courts stood up. And in an 8-1 decision in Hamdi, with only Clarence Thomas saying that the president had that deference, 8-1, the Supreme Court held that an American citizen, Hamdi, was entitled to a lawyer, was entitled to know what charges were being leveled against him, and was entitled to some form of an independent hearing, although they didn't quite elaborate on that. And when it came time for the government to put up or shut up about what they had charged Yasser Hamdi for and what they were prepared to prove, even in a military commission, the government blinked. And they released Yasser Hamdi, who for years they called, as they called Sherman, a terrorist. They plea bargained. They required him to give up his U.S. citizenship, and he moved back to Saudi Arabia where his family was living. So you won't hear any evidence against Yasser Hamdi. We'll talk about the other cases. I want to be sure that I've gotten across to you today that after the Patriot Act was passed, and by the way, it wasn't unanimous, it was 98 senators voted for it. Think of every senator you know in the fall of 2001. Only one senator voted against it. And I've told him personally that when they write profiles in Courage of this time and place, Russ Feingold of Wisconsin will be entitled to a chapter. And 66 courageous men and women in Congress voted against the USA Patriot Act. And the next morning, many of those who voted for it called the ACLU in Washington and said, "What did we just vote for?" Since then, they've realized what they voted for. Bob Barr, former Republican member of Congress, voted for the act. He now calls it one of his worst votes in his years in Congress. Republican Congressman C.L. Butch Otter of Idaho has criticized the act, saying, much as if you would think he was James Madison incarnate, "You cannot give up freedom, you cannot give up liberty and be safe." Dan Young, Republican of Arkansas, went further, calling the Patriot Act the worst piece of legislation we've ever passed. David Keene, chairman of American Conservative Union, predicted that if the Bush administration implements all of its authorities under the Patriot Act for roving wiretaps, reading people's email, putting video cameras on every corner and perusing their library habits, catching terrorists might be easier. We will no longer, however, be living in the same country we lived in before 9/11. And in a lengthy analysis by the Rutherford Institute, a conservative legal foundation, in a report called "Forfeiting Enduring Freedom for Homeland Security," the Conservative Foundation warns that provisions of the act threaten the fundamental constitutional rights of people who have absolutely nothing to do with terrorism. Fortunately, people are beginning to speak up around the country. Over 350 towns and cities have passed resolutions against the Patriot Act. Working through the ACLU and a wonderful website you should check out called the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, BORDC.org, that gives the text of the resolutions, lists all of the cities and towns, and gives links, although links are dangerous, I guess, links to other websites for this effort. I'm going to leave it there so that we get an opportunity to hear from Professor Dahmer, and then we'll have a further opportunity for questions and answers. I hope during that opportunity, if someone is looking for a question, you'll ask me about a young man, Sammy Omar al-Hussein of Boise, Idaho, and you'll ask me about Brandon Mayfield of Portland, Oregon. Thank you very much.
Kidding. In fact, he's probably underestimating how many times he has spoken, because he is the busiest speaker I know. And now we have Professor Dahmer.
I want to join Mr. Rohde in thanking Southwestern for giving us the opportunity to debate these very important issues. I also want to thank Mr. Austin for sharing his story with us. It is a wrenching tale. I am a former prosecutor, but I will be the first one to say that sometimes prosecutors make mistakes, and it sounds like this was one of those cases. Sometimes judges make mistakes, and it sounds like this was one of those cases. And I think it's very important that Mr. Austin continue to share his story, because I think stories like that enable all of us to think long and hard about those portions of the law that need to be changed. I want to address some of the points that Mr. Rohde made. He started out with an interesting historical perspective, and I think that is an important perspective. One of the things, though, that I think is interesting about the post-9/11 world is that I think we have, fortunately, avoided some of the mistakes of the past. And I have in mind now atrocities like the internment of the Japanese during World War II. I think one of the most positive things that happened after 9/11 was that the administration very quickly made it very clear that it would be highly inappropriate for United States citizens to turn against individuals of Muslim background, for example, that it was important that this not become an excuse to demonize people from other parts of the world, and that it was important to keep the focus on stopping terrorism rather than pointing the finger at particular ethnic groups. So I think while we saw an internment after World War II, we have learned from some of the mistakes of the past, and I am happy to see that in a post-9/11 world, there has not been the kind of backlash that we saw in World War II. I think it's very easy to demonize the Patriot Act. It now stands for, in sort of a shortcut way, a knee-jerk way to react against what I think is perceived as excesses on the part of the Bush administration, for example. But I think it's very important that we look carefully at specific provisions of the Patriot Act rather than make a global denouncement of the act. And here is where I think Mr. Rohde and I disagree to a certain extent. Mr. Rohde points to the quickness with which the Patriot Act was passed and acts as though that in and of itself is somehow problematic. But I think we all have to keep in mind the tragedy of September 11th. That was a tragedy, the magnitude of which this nation has never previously known. And God help us, I hope we never know again. We were attacked on that day in a way that this nation has never been attacked before. And I think it, frankly, would have been unconscionable if Congress had not immediately taken action to try to put into place some law enforcement tools that were needed in order to respond to this danger. Now, does that mean that I think that every provision of the Patriot Act is good? Absolutely not. And just like Mr. Rohde doesn't want to be painted into a corner saying that the entire act should be repealed, I similarly refuse to be backed into a corner saying that the entire act is perfect as it is. That's not my position. It's interesting because I think that in this debate, people want to simplify things. That was exemplified today when I got a call from a reporter knowing about this debate tonight, and she said, all right, I don't have a lot of time, Professor Dahmer, but I want to know what's your position. Are you for it or are you against it? And I said, I'm sorry, it's just not that simple. I have a nuanced reaction to the Patriot Act. I think some of the provisions are good. I think some provisions need to be changed. She just couldn't accept that answer. And it was very frustrating to her. But that's the reality of the situation. And in part, that was what motivated me to edit the book that Mr. Rohde kindly mentioned, Civil Liberties Against National Security in a Post-9/11 World, which is an effort to put forth both sides of the debate. But because I think I am mostly here to speak about what I think are the good portions of the Patriot Act, I am going to focus on some of the provisions of the Patriot Act that I think are quite important. Mr. Rohde is correct, I think, although I don't have any inside information. I had left the U.S. Attorney's Office long before the Patriot Act was passed. But I think it's probably right, and it sounds like DOJ has confirmed Mr. Rohde's view, that many provisions of the Patriot Act were drafted before September 11th. And I think I agree with the DOJ that that was appropriate. As a former prosecutor, it was very evident to me that there were a number of provisions in place prior to 9/11 that were frankly obsolete, and I'll just focus on a couple of those. Many of the wiretap provisions in our law, for example, were written at a time when people had one telephone. Cell phones had not been widely used. The internet was not available, et cetera. And so many times provisions for obtaining wiretaps were extremely cumbersome. And if you had a target, just to take a step back for a moment, getting a wiretap is a very difficult procedure. I have applied for numerous wiretaps. It is a lengthy process. It requires you to demonstrate that no other law enforcement tool has been effective. And you go before a court and you establish that there is probable cause under the Fourth Amendment to get a wiretap. Before the Patriot Act was passed, if you had an individual for whom you had probable cause and you were going to get a court order to go up on someone's phone, if that person had a cell phone and as soon as he perhaps suspected that his phone was being tapped, dropped that phone and got another, you had to start the process again. You had to go into court, get a new order for his new cell phone. The Patriot Act in many ways caught up with criminal technology by allowing the government to focus on the individual target rather than the particular phone. No longer, for example, does an AUSA, an assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, if they know that a target is on phones in New York and New Jersey, have to go to a judge in New Jersey, Connecticut, New York. Now they can go to one court, one judge, and get an order that applies to all of the various phones that an individual might be up on. And I think that that was just a common sense change in the law that was needed. And based on my own experience, I think that not keeping up with the technology is simply a short-sighted. And regardless of September 11th, that was a change that was needed. But certainly, after 9/11, that change was dramatically needed, because what we learned on September 11th is that there are very serious threats to our national security, which often do not allow for the luxury of time to go from court to court and get these various orders. There needs to be a streamlined procedure, and that was in part what the Patriot Act was designed to do. Other provisions of the Patriot Act that I think were important deal with what is known as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which is an intelligence gathering apparatus that was put into place back in the 1970s. As you may understand, oftentimes when there is a foreign intelligence surveillance matter, there is overlap between seeking foreign intelligence and doing domestic criminal law enforcement. But prior to the Patriot Act, there was a relatively narrow interpretation of when it was that government could pursue a FISA telephone wire. And that was when the primary purpose of going up on that phone was foreign intelligence gathering. And that was often interpreted by the courts to limit the ability to go up on these so-called FISA wires. One of the changes that was enacted by the Patriot Act was a change in the language so that no longer do you have to demonstrate that that is the primary purpose of your intelligence gathering, but you can show that it is a significant purpose. And in part, what that change in the language means is that there can be information sharing between individuals that are seeking foreign intelligence and law enforcement agencies that are seeking to enforce the domestic laws. And that is an information sharing that, in my opinion, was an important change that was made by the Patriot Act. Mr. Rohde mentioned the three very important Supreme Court cases that were decided in June of 2004, the Hamdi case, which he's described for you, the Rasool case, which involved Guantanamo Bay detainees, and the Padilla case, which involved the so-called dirty bomber who was apprehended at O'Hare Airport and then classified as an enemy combatant. As Mr. Rohde correctly noted, and this is a misperception, I think, often in the popular press, those were not Patriot Act cases. Those cases were not prosecuted under the Patriot Act. They were enemy combatant cases and Guantanamo Bay detainee cases. But what I think was critically important about those cases was the role of the courts in stepping in and putting limits on some of the executive prerogatives that had been claimed under the Bush administration. There are some areas that I think Mr. Rohde and I disagree on with regard to those cases, but I think we basically agree on the notion that one thing that is important in an ongoing basis is an oversight role on the part of the courts. And one of the areas in which I think the Patriot Act has perhaps gone too far is in some of the provisions that carve out roles for the court and suggest court involvement should be limited. I think as a general matter, increased roles for the courts is a good thing. I think one of the critical components, and I'm quoting here or paraphrasing from Justice Souter in his opinion in the Hamdi decision, one of the defining characters of our constitutional government is that there is a constant tension between national security on the one hand and civil liberties on the other. And in Justice Souter's words, we maintain both by partial helpings of each. I think we live in a world that has been forever changed by September 11th. And an unfortunate corollary of that tragedy is that we no longer have the luxury of all of the freedoms that we had before 9/11. Things like airport travel, for example, have changed radically in the wake of that tragedy. And I think that that is an inevitable change. It has been interesting to me in a post 9/11 world to talk to a very dear friend of mine who is an Israeli citizen who lived for many years in New York City. And she has always been struck by the amount of freedom that we in this country have enjoyed vis-a-vis a country like Israel, which, because of its history of a sustained attack, has had a different way of life. And I think the reality is that after 9/11, we find ourselves threatened in a way that we haven't been in the past, and threatened in a way that demands a national security response that is aggressive and proactive and not simply reactive. Does that mean that there are going to be times when there are mistakes made, which it sounds like happened to Mr. Austin? It does. And I think we as citizens must be constantly vigilant to maintain that delicate balance between national security and liberty. But what I often find troubling in these debates is the sense that people hear Patriot Act and react immediately against it without going into depth about what are they arguing against, what provisions do they disagree with, and so on. And I think it's important that we all continue to educate ourselves and have a reasoned debate about issues that could not be more important than this. Thank you very much.
I think just one thing that just caught my attention with the focus supposed to be on terrorism and not on ethnicities or, in my case particular, on, you know, dissent or activists or organizers or whatever, but in particular ethnicities, when, you know, when your average American hears the word terrorist, I don't think they think of, a Caucasian person or someone from, you know, the Western world. I think that image has been embedded in their mind through the corporate media that a terrorist is someone from the Middle East who's Muslim. And I think that if the focus is supposed to be terrorism and not on ethnicities, then I think the way that this war on terrorism is going about is either, you know, one or two things. It's either, you know, completely irresponsible, because the fact that, you know, when we bring up the word terrorism, I mean, we obviously see that when they say terrorism on the news, what do we see pictures of? We see pictures of, you know, Osama bin Laden. We see pictures of Afghanistan. We see pictures of who they call terrorists, insurgents or whatnot. We see pictures of Iraq. We see pictures of the Middle East. I don't think we see, pictures of, you know, other atrocities committed by, you know, people in the Western world and governments in the Western world. But I think that it's either, you know, either irresponsible or it's it's on purpose. It's a media tactic. I think in every war, propaganda is a military strategy, and I think in this particular war, that type of propaganda is a military strategy. So I wouldn't necessarily agree that it's not, the focus isn't not on particularly on ethnicities, but you know, I think it even goes more broad than that. I think the war on terrorism is just said so loosely that, you know, you ask the question, who's the terrorist? I mean, where's the terrorist? I mean, it's like a faceless enemy. It's like they've created an atmosphere of fear where we don't know who the terrorist is, but let's go bomb Iraq because we think they have weapons of mass destruction that they're going to use against us. You know, next we might do Iran, and after that, who knows who else? But you know, maybe we'll lock up some more people in the U.S. because you know this enemy, it can exist anywhere at any time, and I think that's one of the most dangerous things about this new era that we live in. This war on terrorism, it's a new kind of war that doesn't have a particular enemy or specific enemy. The enemy could be anyone. In my case, the enemy was obviously me, and it could be you.
Thank you. Steve?
There is actually quite a bit I'd want to say in response to performance, and hopefully we can weave that into some of the questions and answers. But I also would like to pick up where Sherman left off. There was a little bit too much of a rosy picture painted about the lack of any racism or racial profiling or marginalization of targeted communities after 9/11. The truth is that's exactly what happened. In this time and place, it was the Muslim community. It led to thousands of hate crimes and acts of discrimination against Muslims, against people from the Middle East, even against Sikhs, who lots of miscreants took to be Muslims and Arabs. And unfortunately, it wove its way into governmental action. Also, there was a cowboy mentality, wanted dead or alive. One visit to a mosque by the president hardly makes up for what was happening in this country. And what was happening was that, and this is now documented, this isn't just me anymore, this is documented by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, who issued a report about a year and a half ago in which he documented the fact that because of this terror, because of the tragedy, I want to sort of interrupt myself to say it's particularly at times of great tragedy, great threat, that we need to lift up civil liberties. We need to pay more attention to civil liberties. We need to hold our elected officials responsible for every single violation of civil liberties, whether it's in the name and letter of a statute or in the way in which it has been implemented. And so it was that the Inspector General found that if they had a tip on someone and they went to an apartment or a community and they found that there were people out of status, people who had overstayed their visas, all of these generally men were rounded up and labeled September 11 terrorist suspects. And forever thereafter, in their detention at the Manhattan Detention Center, they were marked as September 11 terrorists. They were held for periods in excess of the periods provided for under the Patriot Act. And that itself was a serious violation. It even went so far as they were offered a phone call to their lawyers. They had a right to call their lawyer once a week. How did the guards in the Manhattan Detention Center enforce that? They came around and said, "How are you doing?" And if someone said, "Fine," they moved on. And "How are you doing" meant, "Would you like to have your legal phone call now?" It's documented by the Attorney General's office. So there's a lot here that we need to talk about. I briefly want to mention FISA, this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, because we've also learned that on 75 occasions, this is a court in which only the FBI and the Justice Department appear, to ask for secret warrants. It's a court that was not created by the Patriot Act. It's been in existence since about 1976. It has a secret because it is in a secret place in Washington. But if they depend on this ex parte proceeding, they depend on the Justice Department telling them the truth, they depend on the FBI telling them the truth. And in 75 occasions, it has now been revealed, the Justice Department misled the FISA court in order to obtain these search warrants. Now, that is wrong. That has to be rooted out, and people, to my knowledge, no one has been held responsible for that to this day. And we'll get into other things as well.
Let me let Catherine have her five to respond, and then I want to let folks here in the audience get a chance to.
Yes, very briefly. I just wanted to note that, of course, before September 11th, probably the most notorious terrorist was Timothy McVeigh. So it's absolutely the case that terrorists come from all walks of life, all ethnic backgrounds, and so on. With regard to Mr. Rohde's point about hate crimes being committed after 9/11, that's true, and that was despicable. My point was not to suggest that there was no backlash against an ethnic group. There was. But fortunately, we did not have the kind of government reaction such as the internment of the Japanese in World War II. What we did have, fortunately, was a Justice Department committed to prosecuting hate crimes and which did prosecute hate crimes in the wake of 9/11, hate crimes directed at the Sikhs and at Muslim Americans and so on. Mr. Rohde mentions the immigration laws and talks about roundups, and again, I would agree that there were excesses in the wake of 9/11, but I'm sure one area where he and I disagree, I think we need to have enforcement at the borders. One of the reasons why September 11th happened was that hijackers were here in this country illegally, and if the INS had been doing its job, some of those hijackers would not have gotten into the United States. In fact, the INS did such a bad job, we now know, that it's been disbanded and reworked into a different component of government. And lax border enforcement, unfortunately, was one of the problems that led to the September 11th attacks. So I think when, again, it would be nice to live in a world where we could have open borders and there weren't, and if there weren't threats to our national security. But that's not the reality today. And there are people in this world, some people like Timothy McVeigh, some from Middle Eastern countries who want to do us harm. And in that kind of world, do we need appropriate law enforcement? Absolutely. Are there going to be abuses? Yes. And we've got to keep a constant vigilant watch on that. But that doesn't mean that we throw the baby out with the bathwater. And again, I think the Patriot Act was an important tool, needs to be changed, needs to be amended. But we should start with that framework and go from there.
Yes, questions. Okay.
I have a comment and a question for Professor Dahmer. The comment is, you mentioned that people sort of declare that, you know, mention the Patriot Act as a talismanic way of referring to the destruction of civil liberties. But aren't you using 9/11 the same way? That in defending the Patriot Act, or parts of it, in your talk, you were constantly referring to 9/11 and the post-9/11 world, and it's not a safe place anymore. And are you saying that the Patriot Act, even the portions that you approve of, can't stand on their own without evidence? I mean, I don't see 9/11 as actually being so different. I mean, it was a big shock to the United States, but that's because we all had our heads buried in the sand. It wasn't a sign that the world has changed. Are you saying that the Patriot Act can't stand without, you know, the excuse of the terror, our sudden realization that people don't like us and would like to do us, if we are the World Trade Center, harm? And I also wanted to comment on the subject of hate crimes and how wonderful it is that the government hasn't, you know, taken a racist kind of internment view of 9/11. That is exactly how I understood George Bush's immediate statement as soon as he came out of hiding, that we shouldn't all target the Muslims and we shouldn't, you know, just because of 9/11, we should all, you know, go on being nice to Muslims, and many Muslims are very nice people. Until then, there was no reason to even conceptualize 9/11 as a Muslim thing. It was really George Bush, you know, the immediate pronouncements, don't blame this on the Muslims, don't blame this on the Muslims, that, you know, suggested to everybody, oh, it must be the Muslims doing this. And the fact that he was saying no, you know, was not anywhere near as powerful a message as it was, that's who it is. And so, because of these Saudis, it's okay to go bomb those Afghans. anyway, that's my comment and my question.
Let me try to go back to your comments and questions and address them one at a time. I think your first question had to do with whether or not I'm using 9/11 in a talismanic way. That's not my intention. Your question, I think, was whether I think the Patriot Act can stand on its own, and I think that's an excellent question. And my answer would be similar to the description I gave at the outset. The entire Patriot Act, I'm not here to defend. Those portions that I do defend, I think, would be defensible whether or not 9/11 had occurred. I think 9/11 was a catalyst for provisions of the Patriot Act because I think it made more dramatically obvious why we needed certain law enforcement tools. But even if you took September 11th out of the picture, and I'll betray my pro-prosecutorial bias here, sure, I would have supported many provisions of the Patriot Act, and indeed, as a former prosecutor, was frustrated by what I saw as technological limits on effective law enforcement that needed to catch up with the sophistication of criminals that we were often dealing with. With regard to your remarks regarding President Bush in the wake of 9/11, let me also just take a step back. And as much as I'm not here to defend the entire Patriot Act, even less am I here to defend President Bush. Indeed, I voted for John Kerry in the election. But having said that, I do think that Mr. Bush was well-meaning in his comments after 9/11. I think we could take a cynical view and suggest that he was pointing the finger at a particular ethnic group. That's not how I interpreted those remarks. I think they are open to different interpretations. I will say that as soon as I had the horrifying experience on that morning of turning on the television 3 hours later, of course, in California than it was in New York, and seeing those planes, the first thing that went into my mind was Osama bin Laden. I knew that name because my office, the Southern District of New York, had indicted bin Laden in connection with earlier terrorist attacks. Of course, he was never brought to trial. But my immediate assumption was that this was the work of bin Laden. I don't think it could have been the work of anyone else. And with the knowledge of the 1993 World Trade Center attacks in my own mind, that was my immediate assumption. And, of course, we learned later about the identities of the hijackers, and as it turned out, they were from a variety of countries and so on. But I interpreted the president, who I have disagreed with on many occasions, but that is not one of the times that I disagree with him. I thought his comments were a heartfelt effort to avoid finger-pointing at Muslims within our midst. I remember teaching a class on that day and being very delighted when a Muslim American student of mine stood up and talked about the importance of not scapegoating. And what was even more heartwarming to me was the reaction of the other students who immediately agreed with that. And so I think that despite the fact that very tragically some people in this country reacted through hate crimes, I don't think that that was the way most people reacted. And I think that, again, we've come some distance, not as far as we need to. We've come some distance from the Japanese internment of World War II.
I wanted to bring out a point that Sherman made, as I understood it, is that the prosecutors knew that he was not guilty of the crime of which he was being held responsible, or which he was accused of. And I heard him say that a number of times. I think his statement rings true. That is that what was happening was a different agenda. That is, it was to quiet the voice that he was allowing to be heard. And I think we are missing the point if we think we're going to fight terrorism by increasing our ability to prosecute crimes. I don't feel any safer because of the airport people at all. I don't feel any safer being searched. I feel much safer if everybody had a free voice to speak in this country. If everybody could just say what they feel and how they feel about it. That's going to make me feel safe, not increase. Now, but I want to... It's heading towards, like, asking for a discussion on something. I think we're missing another point. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay, just incarceration, look at the prisoners in California. Let's not say that we are not doing what we did to the Japanese. The prisoners of California way outstrip what we did to the Japanese. And this is now, here and now. Please discuss that as part of this.
I also have a comment and a question, primarily addressed to the professor's comments. The first comment I have is that I would disagree with the statement you made that the United States has never felt... I think Native Americans would disagree with your comment that this country has never faced that level of terrorism before, as many African Americans would disagree that this country has never faced that level of terrorism before. There's a history of that in this country. That's number one. As would many Arab Americans and Muslim Americans disagree with you that they were not selectively focused on by the government in terms of prosecution with immigration, roundups, deportation, and harassment by the government. Currently, today, as of last week, I could tell you about cases. The comment I'd like you to reflect or comment on is that I thought your discussion was divorced from any kind of historical view of for both the courts and the government's collaboration in terms of oppression and destruction of any kind of social movements, be it the civil rights movement, I think like the Black Panthers or any other group, of destruction of any kind of dissent or a voice. And this is not divorced from the Patriot Act. So there's a long history of the government taking these kinds of actions in collaboration with the courts, and I feel your comments were kind of divorced from any kind of view of that, and if you can comment on that.
Yeah, you've raised a number of interesting points. I think one of the challenges always in a debate like this is how broadly to speak and how narrowly to speak, and my focus was on provisions of the Patriot Act that I support. I think your comments are well taken. Certainly there are a number of groups that you've identified that have faced outrageous oppression by this country. To the extent that my comments were divorced from that, I think that's because I came here with a particular mission, and that was to talk about provisions of the Patriot Act that I support. And that doesn't in any way mean that I don't agree that there are groups in this country that have been victimized in the past. I agree with that.
Thank you. Okay, I have a couple comments or thoughts and a question, too. First, this is mostly directed at Professor Dahmer. The idea that the quick passage of the Patriot Act is not cause for suspicion, I think, is absurd. I don't think it reflects intelligent and thoughtful conduct of our government to have people passing something that's 300 something pages long in less than 24 hours and not even knowing what's in it. So I regard that as highly suspicious and absurd. Secondly, treating as sort of self-evident that our society is forever changed because of 9/11, I think also is absurd. And it's absurd in part because it hands to the personage, if not the person, of Osama bin Laden a victory every time it's used as a pretext to erode further our civil liberties and our civil rights. The idea that we have to be treated like suspects every time we go to the airport is also absurd, and I'll bet it hasn't saved anyone's life. We've all read in the press how they can get shivs and knives and even apparently guns through all this stuff, and yet you're waiting for hours and hours on end. I don't know how much international travel Professor Dahmer does, but I do a fair amount. I've been to Israel, and I've been treated like a suspect there,
and I've been to a lot of other countries, and I love being in other countries now, because you just go to the airport like you used to be here, and you fly places, and guess what? We don't get shot out of the sky. So I don't really think this stuff's necessary. I think it's oppressive, and I think it's done for political show. I'm sorry, my question. My apologies, my question. My question is, I do have a real question. The question is I'm sorry. I know, but I do have a question that anyone basically with a barcode would have would be able to answer. And that is, would a gentleman like Mr. Austin or others who've been pilloried in the press thanks to FBI leaks have a defamation cause of action?
Let me go back to your initial comments. You know, I'm sorry that you think it's absurd to say that our world was changed after 9/11. That is a view that I deeply feel. You are, of course, free to disagree with me and think I'm absurd, and that's one of the things that I like about these debates is that it does reflect the fact that we all have the right to speak our mind. People are doing that here. You view my views as absurd, and, you know, that's what this is all about. I do think that the attacks on September 11th were deeply tragic. And I think it is easy to say, well, it's just like any other attack, but the number of people that were killed on that day is just, I think, a sobering reality. And I disagree. I think we need airport security. I welcome the increased security. That's an area where we obviously disagree. And your final question regarding defamation, I would frankly have to think about that. I haven't taught torts in a while. And I'd have to need to go back and look at the elements of that, so I'm not really prepared to answer right now on that question.
I have a very important comment and question. Am I holding this wrong?
Okay.
One of my comments is I definitely do agree with the fact that we just don't get it. Not all of us, but some of us, just don't get it. The racism, the demonization, the deliberate killing of individuals' characters by this administration, and specifically with the help of the media. Let me read you this headline that was posted in the New York Post, the New York Times, and all over this country regarding my son and his case and the way they characterized him. Headline, "Baby bomb bust. Teen econ protester held for explosives website. A would-be teen terrorist wanted by the FBI." This is just one of many examples of the demonization deliberately executed by our media. And my son's case is just the tip of the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg, and I am extremely frustrated and extremely concerned that no one has ever been held responsible for the types of wording that the media is allowed to use to lynch individuals, whether they be my son Sherman Austin, whether they be someone of Arabic descent, someone whose Islamic. You know, it's irrelevant who the person is. What is relevant is that it is a systematic approach by this government throughout the history of this country to demonize people of color. And there is no difference between my son and his case and what's going on in this country right now with the demonization of people who worship Allah. And I take a personal offense to that. And I take a personal offense to this article and all the other articles that have been printed. And I want to know, not only about my son, but everyone else that's been demonized, I want to know what we can do about it legally as citizens of this country to stop this, to challenge it.
The answer was blunted on November 2nd. That was the first answer. And that means our work is cut out for us. I think the problem is that in each of these cases, there's a lot of overcharging by the government, which then leads to plea bargains. And part of the plea bargains is the extraction of agreements not to sue the government. that happened in the Hamdi case, where he had to agree not to assert any claims against the government after having been held incommunicado without a lawyer and without charges for 2.5 years. In the case that I'd wanted to talk about of Sami Omar al-Hussein, who also maintained a website while he was a student at the University of Idaho, and he was charged with providing material support and expert advice and assistance by maintaining a website which talked about Islam and his faith traditions. But he was also charged under his student visa with violating his student visa because his volunteer time maintaining a website was considered work, and he wasn't allowed to work while he was on a student visa. And when a jury acquitted him of all of the terrorism charges, and jurors later said he had a First Amendment right to maintain a website, the government was able to threaten him with deportation and the other charges that were pending, and they extracted a similar agreement from him. So ultimately, it's going to happen at two levels. It's going to have to happen at a systemic level to change the Patriot Act and the worst of the Patriot Act, and bills are pending in Congress to do that. And you can check the ACLU.org website, and Dennis Kucinich is wonderfully named the Benjamin Franklin True Patriot Act, which would repeal 15 provisions of the worst of the Patriot Act, and you can organize and make your voice heard as far as that is concerned on the macro level. And on the micro level, we need to find cases where people have been abused, get them lawyers, and sue the people and hold them personally responsible for these abuses.
You've been mentioning that there are provisions you guys disagree about, and from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there are provisions like you could be not given an attorney, or you can be held without being charged indefinitely, that they can now use roving wiretaps where they tap you and anybody that you can communicate with either on the net or on cell phones, or that they could take away your citizenship. I think that's in Patriot Act 2. And stuff like that. And if I've missed any, can you inform me? Because I want to know if these are actual provisions that are enacted right now or to come or what.
And we'll both probably have something to say about that. Very briefly, the first part isn't true. The Patriot Act was not a source of stripping anyone of legal representation. That is the Padilla and the Hamdi cases, which are separate from that. But it has been missed that when the government asked for certain powers to hold people for long periods of time, the Patriot Act limits those periods, yet with Hamdi and Padilla, the government went ahead and did it anyway. So the executive branch didn't get certain powers in the Patriot Act, but in the name of calling them enemy combatants, they acted outside the entire law, including outside the Patriot Act. That's often overlooked. There are provisions we haven't talked about just because of the limits of time. Ironically, one of the most infamous is Section 215, which allows library records and bookstore records and, frankly, all business records to be examined. There, I think, is an example of the courts being limited in their role. No probable cause has to be shown under 215 to get those records. The search warrant is clothed in secrecy, and once an FBI agent certifies that the records are sought in connection with a pending investigation, the court shall grant the search warrant. No judicial independence, no oversight, and of course it's a tautology that the records are sought in connection with an investigation. That wouldn't be worth the paper it's written on if they weren't being sought for such a purpose. We've talked a little bit about the expert advice and assistance. That's what the young man in Idaho was charged with. Here in California, in a case involving the Humanitarian Law Project, Justice Judge Audrey Collins struck down those provisions as unconstitutional. And a final one I'll mention are the national security letters, which displace the whole need for courts anyway. The FBI can send your internet provider or a telephone company a letter telling them to turn over your records. The letter ends by saying you can't tell any person about this letter. It raised a serious question whether you could tell your lawyer about the letter. And this was an expansion of existing law, and that was struck down in the wonderfully named case John Doe versus John Ashcroft in New York City. Stripping of citizenship is in Patriot 2. Patriot 2 has not been adopted. It was a big target when it was leaked by the Center for Public Integrity. A portion of it has been passed on administrative subpoenas, but I think we actually stopped the government in its tracks by reacting to Patriot 2, so that stripping U.S. citizenship and the death penalty for domestic terrorism is not yet passed, but the president has pledged to extend the Patriot Act and to seek these other provisions.
I just want to emphasize a point that Mr. Rohde just made, which is that the Patriot Act does not strip individuals of their right to counsel. And I think that that is an important example of a misperception that is out there in the population, that the Patriot Act is this draconian measure that strips rights of citizens. And I think that that's a prime example of something it doesn't do. It doesn't address that at all. The issue of representation did come up in Hamdi and Padilla and Rasul, but it simply is not a feature of the Patriot Act.
Teaching or perception of criminal procedure? I mean, when you teach reasonable suspicion or probable cause, is there an asterisk, you know, subject to application of the Patriot Act or subject to the court's interpretation of the Patriot Act? I mean, what do we see on the horizon, whichever direction it goes, however it's interpreted in the next 10 years or so? What do we see it affecting?
Given
Strassen's miserable case, you know, I mean, that's
If the question is really is how has it affected the way you teach criminal procedure, I certainly think it's true that the terrorism landscape, and by that I mean not just the Patriot Act, but cases like Hamdi, Padilla, and so on, are things that need to be taught and discussed in criminal procedure. One of the things that I try to do in this book, which I use in my advanced criminal procedure class, is I use it starting with the Constitution. You look at the Fourth Amendment, reasonable searches and seizures, and then you look at both sides of it. There we have essays in here from the ACLU that talk about the excesses of the Patriot Act, and then you've got a DOJ memo defending it. The Fifth Amendment, I think, raises issues about interrogation. We know about the abuses of Abu Ghraib, for example, and the extent to which the Fifth Amendment, the right of due process, is implicated. And what I try to do in my class is to present both sides of the issue. And I think that includes ACLU positions. I think it includes the U.S. government position. And my hope always is that students reach their own conclusions about whether we've got the right balance or whether we've tipped too far in one direction or the other.
Legislative history of the Patriot Act, what you discover is that there was an act that was being studied and worked on by the congressional committees involved. There was a negotiation process that went on. There was a bill that was approved by the committee, and then there was a substitute motion introduced by the White House, which was the Patriot Act, and it was passed with no previous committee discussion and no opportunity for Congress to look at it. So on that ground, I would question why you would want not to be painted into the corner of demanding that the entire act be struck. So that's one question. The other question for the professor, some of the provisions in the Patriot Act, my understanding is that right now there's a lawyer in New York who's being prosecuted under the Patriot Act, Lynn Stewart, some of the provisions that the law allows, in addition to her prosecution and the fact they went into her office and took all of her legal documents and those of all of her partners, you don't have to have a law which says a person is not entitled to defense of counsel if the provisions of the law make it impossible for counsel to defend someone. And if you have legalized surveillance of people during their interviews with counsel, then in my mind you've made it impossible for someone to obtain counsel. Similarly, a few other provisions of the law that were hinted at, it's a crime to tell anyone that the FBI came to get their documents. In other words, if a librarian were to tell somebody that the FBI came to her library or his library, they would be prosecuted under the Patriot Act. If a bookstore owner admitted to somebody or disclosed to somebody that the bookstore had been, or any other business, had been interrogated and their their documents taken by the FBI, they would be prosecuted under the Patriot Act. So if you mentioned that there are provisions you don't agree with, I would like you to say if those are some of the provisions you disagree with.
I'll answer my part. You're right about the atmosphere. I want to say that the legislative history of the Patriot Act will also include the word anthrax. This was the anthrax scare. People believed it was the second wave of terrorism. Elected officials were not even in their offices out of fear of anthrax when the Patriot Act was being debated. Questioner's absolutely right. A limited, streamlined bill was moving through Congress. The administration got wind of that. John Ashcroft called a press conference, and he said that opponents of the Patriot Act and critics of the administration were only aiding the terrorists and giving ammunition to America's enemies. And at 3:22 a.m. in a conference committee meeting, the Patriot Act was agreed to and promptly signed the next day by the president. So that is part of that history. My only point is that the courts don't strike down an entire 342-page act. They can look at that history, but then they deal with its specific provisions. And so far, the courts are doing their job, but I don't agree with Professor Dahmer that that's a rosy picture. You know, ask Samuel Hayson, who spent 17 months in jail while awaiting the truth to come out. Ask Yasser Hamdi and ask Jose Padilla if the system is working, just because years later the courts catch up with that. The president and our elected officials raised the same right hand and swore to abide by the Constitution. That doesn't mean pass unconstitutional laws and wait for 3 years in case the people have the resources, time, and means to challenge those laws.
Yeah. Going back to the portions of the gentleman's question that were addressed to me, he mentioned the non-disclosure provisions. And those are portions of the Patriot Act that I disagree with. And in fact, I think you'll be heartened to know that the Southern District of New York, a federal court about 2 weeks ago, specifically held those kinds of portions unconstitutional. That is, the notion that you could prevent any discussion of receipt of letters demanding information, those portions of the Patriot Act were held unconstitutional by a court, and I think appropriately so. So I agree with you, sir, that that would be an example of a provision of the Patriot Act that I think went too far. I think provisions of the Patriot Act that sought to allow national security letters to be served by the FBI with no review by a court were unconstitutional. I think what we're seeing is that the court is rolling back those provisions, and I think that that's exactly what should be happening. Now, you mentioned the prosecution of Lynn Stewart, and I happen to support the prosecution of Lynn Stewart. The individual that is prosecuting her is a prosecutor by the name of Andy Dimber. He's my former boss. But even if you weren't, I think I would support that prosecution. Lynn Stewart signed a contract
that she would not disseminate information, inflammatory information, from a former client. Her former client was an individual who was convicted pre-Patriot Act of terrorism in connection with a bombing threat to blow up the bridges and tunnels leading into New York City. He was a very high-security, high-risk individual, and as part of her representation, she signed a contract agreeing not to disseminate information provided by him to his followers overseas. She violated that, and in light of that, I think she was appropriately prosecuted. I know Mr. Rohde disagrees with me. I've heard him say before she's being prosecuted for holding a press conference. I absolutely disagree. She's being prosecuted for violating the terms of her contract.
As one the brother pointed out earlier, the U.S., whether you talk about foreign policy or economic policy, is not a nation of conscience, not currently or historically. And there are tons of examples that can be shown, as some have been put out, and it's many more that are just now coming out, and many more we'll never know because the people are now extinct. The questions I have is that much of the argument that you've been putting forth has been about trying to create a safe environment for American citizens since 9/11 radically reshaped the terrain in the way we think of safety and the way we think of civilization. The problem becomes in that there are certain people, depending upon how they define themselves, you know, whether it's by race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, class, depends and determines how much loyalty or ethnicity they feel towards a certain establishment. The Patriot Act definitely tries to provide security for people who have been secure historically, and it gives a monopoly on violence to institutions such as the state to defend those people. What are the legal redresses of those people on the underside of empire, of state, of hegemony, who are supposed to turn to these courts, but it's these very courts and establishment that have terrorized and intimidated and coerced, which are the very definitions of terrorism, you know, for centuries. What kind of legal recourses are then allowed to them? And what recourses would you say are allowed then when legal recourses never will not allow or address their grievances?
There's a lot packed into that question. Let me just say that obviously we heard tonight you're an artist and you clearly express, I think, your own views of society and many of the limitations that you see in our country. And let me just say, first of all, that I 100% support your artistic expression and your freedom of expression and your heartfelt views. I sense that if we had more time, you and I could explore areas where we agree and disagree. It seems to me the gist of your question is, how do we ensure that our society is responsive to all peoples, not just the majority of the people? I absolutely agree that one thing that is critical in our democratic society is that we always recognize and protect the rights of minority groups. And I'll just go back to the example that I mentioned earlier about hate crimes. One positive thing that I saw coming out of this was that the Department of Justice did condemn and seek to prosecute aggressively hate crimes that were committed against minority groups in the wake of 9/11. I think that was a good policy on the part of the government. Does that mean that there are groups that feel that their needs are not being met? Unfortunately, I think you're right. I think there are many groups that feel that their needs are not being met. And the only thing I can say is the democratic process, I think, is the best solution we have. I think it's better than an oppressive regime that we see in other parts of the world. Is it perfect? It's not. Do I think that it's best served by the involvement of everyone with all their opinions? I do. I think that's my view.
Again, it may be, is the glass half full or half empty? I don't have as rosy and optimistic a picture of our society. And now I'm getting my chance to tell you about Brandon Mayfield. Some of you know that.
Why don't you ask him? He's going to talk about
it. I'm so glad he asked. He is the Portland, Oregon Muslim lawyer whom the FBI arrested and held, alleging that his fingerprints were found in Madrid, Spain, on material that was associated with the bombing of the train in Madrid. This was one of the most outrageous mistakes by the FBI. The Spanish police told them they had the wrong man, told them their match was faulty, and despite the fact that the FBI had identified several possible matches, it was the Muslim lawyer in Portland, Oregon, who was singled out. And to answer Sherman's mother, Brandon Mayfield is suing the FBI. He is suing them, alleging that his status as a Muslim was an example of racial profiling, that the habituation of racism, the tendency to look at other people and to factor in his status as a Muslim, influenced those FBI agents to target him, to arrest him, to hold him, to resist the opposite evidence that they were getting. So I think the jury is out on the cancerous impact of racism and discrimination and the targeting of Muslim and Central Asian and Middle Eastern communities. I think we are ignorant of the violations that have occurred in that community. We haven't talked about special registration in which people from 26 predominantly Muslim countries were targeted for special registration when people from countries all over the world overstay their visas and engage in other violation of the Immigration Acts, yet those groups were elevated and prioritized by the government. So there's a lot for this government officially to be held accountable for in that regard.
Yeah. Real quick.
My question actually has to do with our response to the attempted bombings of the World Trade Center and the 9/11 attacks, and why we as a culture have looked at rolling back our civil liberties instead of looking at developing international law and enforcement mechanisms, and what the panelists feel of why this is.
Well, I wrote and said immediately after 9/11 that we had an opportunity. We talked about bringing the terrorists to justice. The United Nations immediately enacted or took power under Section 51 of the Charter. There was the chance for international law to play its role in this crisis. For us not to use the knee-jerk reaction of war against Afghanistan, war against Iraq, but to use the United Nations police forces to arrest and prosecute under war crimes and crimes against humanity, that now, 3 years later, we could look back on and know that we had made the world more peaceful, less warlike, than the opposite, which we have done now. This government has withdrawn from the International Criminal Court, which was the dream of Eleanor Roosevelt, which has been enacted by countries across this world, and the fear with the opinions of Alberto Gonzalez was that we could be charged with war crimes for our conduct. So a lot of lawyers were staying up nights at the Department of Justice coming up with opinions to try to clothe what the government was doing and its violations of the Geneva Conventions in a cloak of immunity. I think, hopefully, in a forum yet to be decided, and hardly the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, will some of this be discussed, as the questioner suggested.
I'll be very brief because this is an area where Mr. Rohde and I think largely agree, and that is that we need more involvement by the international community. We live in an increasingly globalized era. We cannot pretend that we are isolated on this planet. We're not. I think we do need more cooperation internationally. I think the United States has not taken all of the opportunities that it should have to cooperate with our partners internationally and do something together. So I think this is an area where we largely agree.
I'm going to just take this one last question. I'm sorry.
For those like Ms. Dahmer and others that believe that there are people who want to do us harm, do y'all realize that in between the communists and the terrorists, it was the giant meteorites that were going to get us? I mean, doesn't the government try and perpetuate fear in order to control?
I think that's right. One study of what's called national security states looked at 12 factors when one studies the movement toward totalitarianism or national security states, as it's more currently called. And one of those factors is media in the service of the state. And we could adjourn and reconvene for an entire examination of the weakness, the utter spinelessness of the American media. And I don't have to just single out Fox and CNN. Dan Rather had to go to London to tell a talk show of the muzzling and the self-censorship that he operates under in this country. So that is a serious issue. We don't have time to explore it. The only hope we have are the independent voices, KPFK, the internet, documentary filmmakers, and others who are ignoring mainstream media in order to channel other information out to people. And I promised the producers of Unconstitutional to encourage anyone in this audience who is not yet aware of Unconstitutional, the war on our civil liberties, which goes to the heart of what we're talking about tonight, Unconstitutional, the movie, .org, where you can find that documentary. So those issues are very important as well.
Just briefly, I don't share the same cynical view of the government or the media. I think largely our government is trying in good faith to do what it thinks is right. Many people in this room disagree with me, but that's your right.
Sherman, did you have, I'm going to have to stop, and the folks are really upset, but I know you all will stay a little bit to talk, but I want to give you an opportunity if you had a couple of closing remarks before we...
Sure.
If you want. Look, guess, you know, I'm not trying to force you. Hey, you've got the right to remain silent. That's the one you've been told about too much, right?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I guess just to comment on your question again, I guess as I was saying before that, you know, in every war, there's a, you know, there's propaganda, and I think that's propaganda is used as a military strategy. And it's there to, you know, serve the interests of the war and serve the interests of the state. And it's, you know, if you look at any war the U.S. has been involved in, I mean, we see that same propaganda being used and being, you know, fed into people's homes. And it's used, I think, to create an hysteria of fear, create an atmosphere, create a level of threat, a level of, you know, justification is why we need to, you know, do the things we do when it comes to our foreign policy. And I think that, you know, especially with, you know, alternative voices and independent media and, you know, radios like radio shows like on KPFK and indie media and, you know, independent filmmakers making documentaries, I think those are, you know, one of the most important things we have right now is to educate people and create a voice in this country to create new perceptions that challenge the corporate media by ignoring the corporate media and creating the media amongst the people. Because, I mean, as way things look now, I don't think with the money and power invested in, you know, the media and corporations that we can necessarily challenge them through money and through, you know, the legal system. I think we're going to have to take initiative and take things into our own hands and create a media with our own communities and challenge them that way and hopefully make that media grow and establish networks where we can continue to educate people and get out the truth and challenge them through education. And through that will come action and inspire more people to get involved and start organizing within their communities and make change.
Thank you.
Steve, you never have anything little to say.
I've written a paper on the anniversary of the Patriot Act. I'm leaving a copy of it with Professor Gunning, if anybody would like copies of that. And I just discovered the last comment, and no better to quote than James Madison. Listen to this. The fetters imposed on liberty at home have ever been forged out of the weapons provided for defense against real, pretended, or imaginary dangers from abroad. Thank you very much.
Anybody would like more information on Sherman's case, they can go to www.freesherman.org. Lots of links and info.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, everyone, for coming. This was fabulous. I think, Katie, do you have some last thing that you wanted to say besides?
30 seconds, if you'll give it to me.
Yes. I mean, Steve stole his.
These issues could not be more important. The tensions between security and liberty are real. They are important issues to talk about. They are issues that are obviously important to everyone here. The only final word I'd like to say that one of the most important freedoms that we all share is freedom from fear, and that's an important freedom as well. Thank you.